Persephone had managed only the one roving so far. What was supposed to result in a long, uniformly thick strand of clean fibers remained a short, dirty wad. She would have switched to combing, but Bryn assured her that carding was easier. The girl had enlisted all of them, even Malcolm and Wraith. No one could turn down Bryn's bright smile, and there was a lot of wool.
"Hedera?" Moya asked. "She's probably just sleeping up there."
"She took some knitting, I think."
"She's definitely sleeping, then."
Bryn leaned over, looking out at the rain.
"Where is Suri?"
The girl was nearly as fascinated by the mystic and her wolf as she was by Wraith. Nearly. Nothing could distract Bryn from the Dorian for long, and she delighted in teaching him to card. Not surprisingly, Wraith got most of her attention, and his rovings were good, whereas Persephone's and Malcolm's suffered from neglect.
"Outside," Moya said,
pumping the foot pedal of the spinning wheel and making it hum. "Her and her wolf."
"In the rain?" Bryn asked.
"She doesn't like being inside," Persephone said. This caught Roan's attention. She was the only one not actively employed in the wool chores. Instead, she was on her knees, near the cluttered rear of the house, sewing a patch of cloth to the side of her tunic.
"Suri, or the wolf?"
Roan asked with a worried tone. "Both, I suspect. But it has nothing to do with you, Roan. Suri is uncomfortable inside any place. She doesn't even like being inside the walls of the doll." Roan responded with her hallmark almost smile, a trait as typical of her as Gifford's walk or lisp. Life had battered them both. Gifford was a cripple on the outside, Roan on the inside, and Persephone wondered if that was the price of divine gifts.
"All these people. All these amazing people."
She was haunted by visions of their bleeding bodies lying in the dirt as the doll blazed. Persephone saw their future as she saw the leaf outside, teetering on the edge in a growing wind.
"So much in jeopardy. So much at stake. And yet, what can a leaf do to influence the wind?"
"So why is she still here?" Moya asked.
"Suri?"
Persephone looked up from her carding. "Still trying to work out why I was attacked, I think. Has something to do with bones," she told me.
"Any clues?"
Persephone shrugged. "If she has any, she's not told me. Maybe she wants to get all the facts straight first."
"Speaking of puzzles,"
Bryn said to Wraith, as she knelt before him, helping in the creation of another perfect roving,
"what's the answer to the riddle?"
"Riddle?" he asked.
"The one you posed to the Crescent Forest."
Bryn sat up straighter, closed her eyes and recited,
"Four brothers visit this wood. The first is greeted with great joy, the second is beloved, the third always brings sad tidings, and the last is feared. They visit each year, but never together. What are their names?"
"You remember all that, word for word?"
Moya asked, amazed.
"Excellent, Bryn," Persephone said. "Just like a true keeper."
Bryn smiled.
"I only heard it once, but I keep trying to solve it. Not that I'm wiser than the Crescent. I mean, you asked the forest, and it didn't know the answer, right? So how could—"
"Spring, summer, autumn, winter,"
Roan said from the back of the room. They all turned and stared. Noticing the silence, Roan looked up.
"That's right, isn't it? The names of the four brothers?"
"Yes," Malcolm said with a little smile. "Yes, it is."
"Seems sort of obvious once you hear the answer,"
Moya said. Malcolm narrowed his eyes at Roan. "Pardon me for asking, but I'm curious. Why are you sewing a patch on your tunic? There's no hole, is there?" not even a wear mark.
It's not a patch, she replied. It's a pocket.
What?
A pocket. That's what I call it. You know, like a poke, a little sack. But this is a tiny one, so it's a pocket. See?
Roan picked up a bit of string from her work table and slipped it in. Then she let go, leaving it there as if she'd performed a magic trick.
Because it's open on top, I can put stuff in and take it out with one hand, and it's always with me.
That's brilliant, Malcolm said. As long as you don't stand on your head, Moya brought up.
I don't think Roan will be... Persephone began, and stopped when Moya gave her a surprised look.
This is Roan we're talking about, Seth. 2 weeks ago I stopped her just seconds before she stuck a needle in her eye.
Persephone looked at Roan aghast.
Whatever for? She wanted to find out how deep the socket was.
Moya answered for her.
Oh, blessed Mera. Roan, don't ever do that, Persephone said.
Okay.
Roan nodded without the slightest indication that she understood why. She then looked back at Malcolm.
I was thinking of putting a pocket on both sides.
She placed her hand on the other hip, marking the spot.
Next time Padera asks for needle and thread, I won't have to fumble with a pouch's drawstrings.
You're a marvel, Roan,
Moya told her.
A little batty, but amazing all the same.
She's not batty, Persephone said. She's a genius.
Roan shook her head self-consciously, and once more displayed the disbelieving look that broke Persephone's heart.
What sort of monster was Ivor?
Persephone had liked the man. Strange how it was possible to see someone for years, yet still not know him.
What do you think Conniger will do now?
Moya asked. Her spinning wheel made a little breeze in the house.
Sarah told me he and Tressa are staying with the Coswells, Persephone said. I didn't mean to drive them out. They could have stayed.
No one will go near the lodge now, not even the Galantians, not while she's in there. Well, except for you three. Of course, Suri's a mystic, so nothing she does surprises anyone. And Padera would spit in a bear's eye.
What's she got to lose, right? The woman's lived the equal of 10 normal lives, probably tired of it all.
And me? Persephone asked. What are people saying about me?
Persephone knew there was talk. There was always talk. Life in a doll was filled with endless days of mundane, repetitive tasks, and gossip was the only entertainment. After Hegner's accusations, the death of Sackett and Adler, and the arrival of Wraith, the Frey, and the Myrilleth, there was a lot to talk about. All of it in whispers whenever she was around, so Persephone knew much of it was about her. Moya slowed down, letting the wool play out.
Don't know how reliable it is, but Autumn told me Conniger is spreading a story about you trying to take over. That's why you drove him out of the lodge. One more step in your master plan.
My master plan?
All I'm trying to do is save the Myrilleth's life, and this doll in the bargain. I put her in there because it's warm and dry.
I'm not the one complaining, Moya said.
And I know everything Hegner and Conniger are spewing is complete rubbish, but...
What if it wasn't?
Moya, you can't possibly think...
Moya shook her head and held up her hands.
No, I don't mean it that way.
She looked around at the others, most of whom saw the seriousness in her eyes, and stopped what they were doing.
What I mean is, maybe you should become chieftain.
Clan chieftains are men, Wraith said.
No, Moya replied. They just always have been.
Well... Yeah, and that's because any member of the clan can challenge a chieftain to combat for control of the clan, Wraith replied. At least that's how they did it in Terea. Not so many women are keen with a spear or axe.
and a chieftain needs to be capable of leading men into battle, which means you want the strongest and toughest.
People in Wren don't go to battle every week,
Moya pointed out. Never been a battle in my lifetime. Still, it helps to have a man in charge to keep order.
Moya's face hardened.
Seems Persephone is the one keeping the order around here, not Conniger. When it comes to keeping order, I'd rather have someone using the head above their shoulders than the one below the waist.
This brought a round of smiles, and a few glances at Bryn, who looked puzzled.
But how well would she fare in a one-on-one fight with him? Wraith asked.
The ability to kill someone shouldn't be how we choose our chieftain, Moya said.
What should be and what is are usually very different. Doesn't change the fact that armed battle is how these things are decided.
She could have a champion fight for her, Bryn said.
Both Moya and Wraith looked at the girl.
According to the ways, anyone can have a champion stand in for them so long as that person agrees to fight and has no desire to be chieftain themselves.
Is that true?
Moya asked. Bryn nodded.
I thought everyone knew that.
Not everyone studies the ways like you, Bryn.
Moya turned to Persephone.
There you go. Have Wraith fight Conniger and take the first chair.
I wouldn't ask someone to risk their life for me.
He fights gods.
You're only asking him to kill Conniger. I don't think there's much of a risk.
The Frey aren't gods, and I don't care if it was Cobb being challenged. I wouldn't ask such a thing of anyone, especially someone I hardly know,
Persephone said, while avoiding looking at Wraith.
The man had feelings for her, and she was calling him a stranger.
You just don't want to be forced to marry Hegna.
Of course. Would you?
Would anyone?
But that's not the point. Fact is, you'd be a great chieftain. We all know it. Those of us capable of thought, anyway.
Everyone looks to you in an emergency, and not a single person hesitated when you said, take the Frey into the lodge.
I was just a kid, but I remember the famine and how you saved us.
My mother hated you, by the way.
Oh, thanks for that, Moya.
Persephone frowned.
Always glad to add another name to the long list of people who've hated me.
Let me finish.
Moya rolled her eyes.
She cursed your name every night because you convinced Reglan to ration the grain.
She turned to Bryn, who had stopped carding to listen. Bryn loved stories.
The long winter was over. Summer was here. Crops were looking great, but everyone was hungry because Persephone demanded the granary remain locked.
A lot of people hated me for that, Persephone said softly, remembering what, at that time, had been the worst year of her life.
She had survived back then by thinking life couldn't get any worse. Maybe that was why everything was so upside down on the doll since Suri's prediction of death. The gods felt the need to prove her wrong.
My mother said, the only reason Reglan appeased you was because you nearly died in childbirth a few weeks earlier.
Moya continued.
He was worried about you, and my mother said you used your loss to get your way. She thought you forced the ration because you wanted the rest of us to suffer along with you.
Your mother said that?
Moya nodded.
And you wondered why I didn't cry at her funeral? Well, it was stuff like that.
What happened?
Bryn asked.
I never heard this story.
I wish I could say the same, Persephone said, looking out at the rain.
You were young then, Bryn. This was, what, 10 years ago?
Moya asked.
11, Persephone said. But let's not talk about it.
Oh, no, you have to finish it,
Bryn pleaded. I might be the next keeper, and this could be important.
You know, for the future. In case something like that happens again. Please.
Moya shrugged.
You tell it, Seth.
You know it better than anyone.
Persephone was quiet for a long time,
Then she sighed and said, "It started with Tura. She had come from the forest and warned Reglan and me about a famine. I believed her, but he didn't. Part of the reason was because Tura so infrequently visited the Dáil. For her to come, it must have been important. Another reason was because I knew how low our stores were, and how much people wanted to gorge themselves after so long on rations. If Tura was right, and we didn't take precautions, the entire Dáil would have starved. I pleaded with Reglan to seal the granary. People were hungry. They almost revolted. They saw no reason for such measures. I had never fought so vehemently with him before, but I couldn't back down. Maybe Reglan did go along just to calm me, I don't know. But he heeded my pleas." Persephone paused, and the room was silent. "When spring came, everything was fine. The crops were growing well, and everyone gave me angry looks. I ended up spending the nice weather holed up in the lodge. Then the storms came. Weeks of them. Wind, hail, and rain destroyed everything. After that, there was a drought. 2 whole months without more than a few miserable drops of rain. Just when we thought it couldn't get any worse, winter came early. We went into it with only what we had saved in the granaries. That was the start of the Great Famine. There were a lot of deaths. We stacked the bodies in the snow because the ground was too hard to dig. We waited for spring to bury them. When bodies started to disappear, Reglan and I prayed it was wild animals, or even ghouls, stealing them."
"But you saved us," Moya said. "No one would have survived otherwise, and everyone knew it. People listened to you after that. They still listen to you. You just have to talk to them."
Persephone shook her head.
"Conagher is chieftain."
"Sure, now he is, but you could..."
"No, Moya. Don't you see? When Reglan agreed to ration food that spring, what would have happened if your mother had found herself a Dorian warrior and challenged him for leadership? How would that have been? You wouldn't have liked that, would you?"
"Conagher isn't a great chieftain, not yet. But if we stand by him, he could be. He just needs a little help at the moment. And it doesn't help that Hegner is whispering lies about me."
"Conagher is worthless. Did you know he named Hegner as his new shield?" Moya said. "What kind of idiot makes a one-handed man their bodyguard?"
"There has to be a reason. He's just not telling us. When I was second chair, Reglan and I couldn't always tell everyone everything. We had secrets we had to keep hidden for the good of the clan."
"Like what?"
"Like what really happened to the missing bodies waiting for a spring burial."
"What did happen?"
"Let's just say it wasn't animal tracks we found." Suri sat in the rain outside Roan's home, her back against the doorposts and legs outstretched to the edge of a mud puddle. Mina lay beside her, the big pile of wet fur rising and falling with the wolf's breath. As always, the animal's heat kept her warm. The mystic had the loop of string in her hands again, weaving another web with the added challenge of the rain, which created pretty liquid jewels on the string. Suri felt time slipping away, and she had to think. The yakking going on in the roundhouse was distracting, but the rain helped. The grey curtain and the constant patter assisted in blocking out the rest of the world. Not all of it. She could still hear the conversation inside if she listened. That was where the string came in. It helped her concentrate. Strings were like that. So were ponds. Hard to find a good thinking pond, though. They needed to be isolated in a deep wood with plenty of cattails and dragonflies and few, or preferably no, biting bugs.
A good thinking pond was located on the northern side of the crescent, but it was too far, so she settled for her string.
What is the secret of the bear?
If she'd had a chance to speak to Conniger, she might have learned something.
The bear might be a Bendigo, Morvin, or Yuccas.
A Bendigo she could deal with, a Yuccas would be bad. She didn't think it was a Yuccas. They killed with sickness, and so far everyone had been ripped apart. It was probably a Morvin. In fact, it was most likely a Morvin. The eating of people was a big hint, but she didn't want to face a demon on a guess. Despite the sound of the rain and the distraction of string, Suri heard Persephone's accounting of the Great Famine.
We stacked the bodies in the snow because the ground was too hard to dig. We waited for spring to bury them. When bodies started to disappear, Reglan and I prayed it was wild animals, or even ghouls stealing them.
That was particularly strong evidence they were dealing with a Morvin, unless Persephone was right about having a ghoul problem. Suri pulled the string through her fingers, thinking about bears and forest spirits. One thing was certain. Death was coming, unless she could stop it. And she couldn't stop it unless she understood what it was. Inside, the conversation had shifted from famine to a debate about who the chieftain ought to be. Wraith and Malcolm were also in there, but said little. She liked that about them. Reminded her of Mina. Fools believe silence is a void needing to be filled. The wise understand there's no such thing as silence.
"Nice wolf,"
said a young man, hobbling forward, assisted by a wooden stick under one arm. His back was twisted, his face misaligned, one eye and the corner of his mouth higher than the other. His right shoulder was pinched up to his cheek, and his left leg dragged as if one foot were dead. He wore a surprisingly clean tunic, although at that moment it was soaked through. His hair was combed neatly back, which was probably easier since it was wet. In his free hand, he held a beautiful clay amphora with an enamel finish. Around the belly of the pot was the image of a woman with a broken chain in her hands.
"Her name is Mina," Suri replied.
"First wolf with a name I've met."
The man paused.
"Come to think of it, I can't say I've met a wolf."
He spoke slowly, deliberately, and sounded as if his nose was stuffed.
"Pleased to meet you, Mina. I'm Gifford."
"What's wrong with you?" Suri asked. "Are you cursed?"
Gifford laughed.
"Many times, I suspect."
"Nice stick," Suri said. "I have a staff, but never tried using it that way."
Roan came out of the roundhouse.
"I call it a crutch."
"She made it for me," Gifford said. "Should have named it without an R, though."
The cripple smiled, or the closest thing to a smile that his face could produce.
"I'm sorry, Gifford. I should have thought about that. We could change its name,"
Roan said.
"No, it's fine."
He held out the amphora with his free hand. Rainwater splashed off its sides. The few drops that found the opening made a deep, hollow sound.
"Roan, this is a peasant I made you. I think it's my best yet."
Roan didn't move. Her hands covered her face as she stared at the ceramic vase, shocked.
It's lovely. And is that the new glaze?"
He nodded.
"Inside and out. difficult to paint the inside, too. Took awfully long to do.
You can't give this to me.
I don't see why not. I made it for you. It has a an image of you.
Roan bent over and peered closely.
That's me.
Who else?
Roan squinted at the image as raindrops ran down the side of the ceramic.
But she's beautiful.
Uh-huh.
Gifford nodded.
Exactly. Now, please take it. It's quite light, but holding it out like this is...
Oh, sorry.
Roan took the vase, continuing to marvel at it.
This is a work of art. I don't understand why you would give such a thing to me.
Gifford hesitated a moment. Suri had trouble understanding the expressions of people, and seeing as how Gifford's face was already squished and askew, he was harder to gauge than most. Still, he looked as if he was about to say something, then changed his mind. He made an attempt to shrug, but only one shoulder responded.
Goes with the set of cups I gave you.
You can't keep giving me things.
Did the chieftain pass a new law?
He gave another lopsided smile, but Suri imagined all his smiles were that way.
Even if he did, I'd break it.
Roan looked flustered.
I meant that I don't deserve this, any of these things. I'm just a...
He's dead, Roan,
Gifford told her, his voice louder.
You not a slave now. You free. And I'd...
The potter bit his lip and sucked in a noisy breath through his nose.
Cups and pots would be the least I would give you. If I could. If I wasn't.
Gifford squeezed his lips together and stared at Roan. The two of them stood in the rain, facing each other and breathing hard so that their breaths created a single cloud. Roan hugged the big amphora to her chest and asked,
Are you all right?
No,
Gifford said miserably, then glanced at Suri.
She'll tell you. I'm cursed.
Roan looked puzzled.
Cursed?
Suri clarified.
Yeah, that. Keep the pot. Break it. Give it away. You can do what you want, Roan. You can do what you want because you free. Remember that. And you beautiful, too. You should have the best of anything. But all I have to give you is a pot.
He offered one last misshapen smile, or maybe that one was a frown.
Nice meeting you, Mina,
Gifford called as he limped away. The wolf lifted her head at the sound of her name.
Who cursed him?
Suri asked Roan as she continued to watch Gifford hobble off.
What?
Roan looked down at her, puzzled for a moment.
Oh, the gods, maybe. He was born that way.
His mother died giving him life,
Persephone said, appearing in the doorway. She was looking at Roan, a sad expression on her face. When he was born, the people of the Dal thought it would be best to leave him in the forest, but his father refused. He said Gifford was a fighter like his mother, and he was right. The son of Arya just may be the bravest man on the Dal.
What do you mean, leave him in the forest?
Suri asked.
Hmm?
Persephone looked over.
Oh, well.
Some children, the unwanted ones, are sometimes given over to the mercy of the gods. Suri let the string fall from her hands.
The next morning, Wraith went to work on the eaves of the forest. His shirt was off and his swords hung from a nearby tree branch. He was still carrying his father's broken blade, for reasons he couldn't put into thoughts. The sky was clear blue after the rain, and the light of the climbing sun pierced the leaves in shafts. Out where the forest met the field, out in the stillness of a dewy dawn, it was possible to forget the world was ending.
Or is it?
The question itself appeared up for debate. The doomsayers, and Wraith acknowledged he had been one, believed the Frey were coming to kill them all, and him in particular. But the Frey had come three times, stayed twice, gone once, and everyone was still alive. The whole affair was almost enough to inspire hope.
Almost. What fun is there in crushing the hopeless? Like with pigs or cows, there is a period of fattening before the slaughter.
The gods are just waiting for the right time. And my time is running out. Why am I still here?
The answer was obvious. He just wasn't happy about it. He wiped his face and remembered the land across the rivers where his father had dragged him. Herkimer had been wrong about many things, but not about that place. While exploring, he and his father had crossed both the Burn and the great Urum rivers, where Wraith had beheld paradise. On the far side, he'd climbed a hill and seen a new future for himself. A land the Frey called Avrilin was filled with lush fields and rich forests. That was where he wanted to go, where he hoped to live. Afterward, Herkimer had picked the meadow at the convergence of the two rivers, but Wraith couldn't get the other hill out of his mind. He couldn't go there alone. Even his father had understood that and brought Wraith along. Probably would have sent Wraith back to get a wife once they were established. Maybe given a year or two, Persephone might change her mind, and if she came, others would too. He fantasized about her, Malcolm, Suri, and a few of the others joining them. They could do it. Together they could build something. Something beautiful. He picked up the axe again. Since the death of Crya, there had been a notable lack of volunteers to cut wood and an abundance of talk regarding the community's dwindling supply. When the morning arrived, without rain, Wraith borrowed an axe from Roan. She apologized when handing it to him, saying she'd made it the previous fall after the season's wood supply had been cut, so no one had tried it yet. She continued to apologize three more times in the event it didn't work well. Apparently, she had beaten the blade from a chunk of metal she and Gifford had found when searching for glaze materials. Wraith hadn't used many axes in his life. Trees were rare at Dol Guldur, but he'd gone with his father and some others during their pilgrimage to a forest far to the south. The few axes he had used were straight poles, with a wedge of flint jammed into a split on one end and lashed tight with leather strips. Usually, a strong man needed an entire day to drop and reduce a tree to usable pieces. Doing so would leave him with aching arms, and the axe heads broke so often that dozens of replacement flints were brought along. The tool Roan had given him was nothing like the ones he'd used before. It had a long, curved handle that went through a hole in the metal head. When he swung, Wraith cut through small limbs in a single stroke, bark and all. Working alone, he'd already taken down a respectable maple, and limbed it in less than 2 hours. The axe had to be magic. He dragged the leafy branches out of his way, and then rested, catching his breath with 1 foot up on the body of the naked trunk. He marveled at the bright nibs of wood the axe had clipped away so cleanly. "If I were a bear, you'd be dead,"
Wraith whirled, lifting the axe in defense. Behind him stood a Frey, the one who had disarmed him during the fight with Nephron. Sebek stood casually, weight on his heels, back straight, chin high, arms relaxed. He wore only a leather skirt and sword belt. His bare chest appeared just as bronzed, just as indelible as armor. Sculpted by the morning sun, his body was a series of sharply hewn muscles. A landscape of lean strength. Angled planes formed his face. High cheeks, a broad jaw, and precise lips. Cold and blue, the Frey's eyes smiled with a hungry delight. Wraith didn't say a word. He looked toward his sword, still hanging on the tree branch. The Frey was between him and his weapons. Sebek saw the glance. He stepped back, picked up Shigon's blade, and swung it menacingly. "This is a terrible sword," Sebek said. "Gaudy, heavy, and too long. But I suppose you like long blades. They are the weapons of cowards who fear getting close to their enemies." He tossed the weapon to Wraith. But before he had time to catch it, Sebek had both of his blades drawn. "These are Nagan and Tabor," the Frey said, holding the twin cleaves up. "Lightning and thunder, each forged from the same batch of metal by preeminent Durg Smiths." "Durg Smiths? Is that why the blades are so short?" Sebek grinned, and in that toothy smile, Wraith saw danger. "He doesn't just like fighting. He loves it. And he probably has more than a passing affection for those swords." "Short swords are fast, and I'm not afraid to get close." Like a big cat, Sebek began to pace. As he did, he continued to take practice swipes in the air. "You made a number of mistakes when fighting Nephron."
"And yet I won. Or would have."
"Would you?"
"No way to know for sure now, is there?"
Sebek gave a little laugh. "I know."
"Good for you."
That grin again. "You don't believe me? Don't think I can tell the outcome of a fight before it starts?" Wraith didn't have to believe. He knew. But showing weakness in front of Sebek wasn't a good idea. Wraith moved to slip the sword into his belt.
"Not yet," Sebek said. "I want to show you where you failed."
"Not interested. Chopping wood. You're interrupting."
"You can chop wood later. If you survive."
Wraith was waiting for the attack. He'd expected it since Sebek appeared. He just couldn't anticipate what an attack from Sebek would be like. He was faster than Nephron. Wraith didn't see the blade. Once more, Wraith acted on instinct and was right. He met Sebek's sword. The moment they collided, the impact jarred the weapon from his hand, just as in their first encounter. An instant later, the point of thunder, or was it lightning, was pressed against his throat. Wraith didn't move. Sebek nodded, as if they were having a conversation, then pulled back and walked 5 strides away.
"Pick it up."
Wraith was already in the process, wiping the sweat from his palms on his lemur.
"It's not your fault, I suppose,"
Sebek said.
"You're so young. You show promise, but you lack experience.
You can trust me on that.
I'm senior captain of the guard and master of arms at Alan Rist. I'm also a shield to Nephron. I've trained and tested thousands. Now, let's see if you can get Shigon's sword anywhere near me."
The bad news was that Wraith saw no hope of avoiding a fight he had no chance of winning. The good news was that Sebek didn't appear to want to kill him. At least not right away. Sebek dodged his first stroke with no effort. On his next swing, the Galantian displayed his speed, slamming Wraith in the face with the butt of lightning.
or was it thunder this time?
Wraith staggered, his eyesight blurred, and he tasted the blood running down from his nose.
Get serious or I'll beat you unconscious. Here, I'll make it easier.
Sebek sheathed one of his swords.
Now, try again.
Wraith shook his head and spat, shifting his feet the way Herkimer had taught. He drew in his elbows and then leaned to the right until Sebek shifted his weight. At that moment, he spun left, swinging the blade horizontally, and attacked Sebek's undefended side. He expected to slice Sebek across the chest. Amazingly, Sebek deflected the blade with his hand. His empty hand. The fray slapped the flat of the blade, driving it down and away. Wraith pivoted once more and swept high. Again, Sebek slapped the blade aside. Frustrated by the ease with which the fray deflected his attacks with a bare hand, Wraith swung harder and faster. Following one stroke with another, he closed the distance between them. Sebek became pressed enough to use both his hand and a sword to deflect the attacks. But then, when Wraith thrust the sword at his chest, the fray caught his blade with his hand, twisted it, and once again disarmed him.
"Your father wasn't a good teacher," Sebek said, handing the sword back. "You're slow, predictable, as graceful as an ox trapped in mud, and have no strategy for attack. I'm surprised Nephron had so much trouble with you, but I think he wanted you to win. Still..."
Sebek nodded slowly, thoughtfully. "You're much better than I expected. Much better than I would have thought a rune could be."
"Are we done, then?"
Wraith asked, picking up Roan's axe.
"Yes, I got what I wanted."
"What was that?"
"The truth."
Chapter 20. The Prince. We were foolish to think the Frey were gods, but it was insanity for the Frey to believe it too. I'd rather be foolish than insane. The Book of Brynn. As he rode alongside Grendel at the head of a small column of soldiers, Moandoulé worked hard to hold a stoic expression. Locking his teeth together, he stiffened his lips, which were constantly trying to betray him. His eyes were wide, but there was no helping that. He had no idea how to be casually in awe. Moandoulé desperately wanted to appear as the unflappable prince of the realm, instead of a sheltered youth seeing the magnificence of the world for the first time. The flaw in the plan was that he wasn't, and he was. Since leaving Estremnadon, Moandoulé had gazed dewy-eyed at the great Partholorian Falls, the marvellous tower of Avampartha, the snow-capped peaks of Mount Mador, the fjords of the Green Sea, and finally the broad, sweeping vista of Rulin. The sheer size of everything was incredible. And the colours! The sun playing on the barren hills and stony mountains produced a strange beauty. The harsh landscape sang of adventure and secret. He saw himself travelling the wasteland alone, climbing the jagged ridges and peering into lost caves. He imagined discovering Durg treasure guarded by sleeping dragons, which he would slay. Or perhaps the guardians would be a troop of Durg, the little monsters with their shining metal weapons lashing out from underground hiding places. In every fantasy, he was victorious, although he allowed himself to almost be beaten in a few of his daydreams before making his enemy pay dearly. When Alan Rist appeared on the horizon, the sight was beyond boyhood imaginings. Moandoulé couldn't have dreamed that big. This was the stuff of legend. The great tower looked like an upthrust spear, punching out of the ground, stabbing the sky. The dome might have been the helmet of a giant, hidden just below the surface of the great hill.
Such scale wasn't possible beneath the trees of Erevan.
This was a place, open and free, a land of heroes, a home for adventure. Even seeing it from afar, Mwandulay fell for the romance, the grandeur, and the excitement he imagined as daily realities.
No one is forced to learn how to make string patterns in a place like this. No one needs to practice juggling inside a thrusting spearhead.
Mwandulay wondered how often Alan Rist was attacked. Regrettably, the war with the Derg had ended long before Mwandulay's birth. But the little cretins still existed, cowering in their dark places under the earth, seeking revenge and a return to the world of light.
Once a month, maybe. Once a month would be good.
Mwandulay knew Grendel wouldn't linger at the outpost long. Only a week or two. But he hoped they might be around for at least one assault. As the son of the Fane, he would, of course, command a battalion of soldiers. And, as one of only three Miraleth on the frontier, he would also command their awe. Mwandulay imagined hordes of Derg scaling the cliffs and walls, emerging like droves of armored crabs or hairy spiders from every cleft and crevasse. Mwandulay's troops would be shrieking in fear, but their young prince would boldly step forward and refuse his counselor's pleas to don armor. Fearless, he would look down at the enemy from the balcony of the...
"Miserable desolation,"
Grendel muttered, as they began the final climb toward the outpost. Mwandulay's new teacher was scowling. No, it was more of a sneer.
"Look at this."
He gestured at the fortress of Alan Rist.
"They practically live in a cave. Little wonder they've become animals. This whole land is worthless, the armpit of the world, an empty, forgotten basin of rock. Even trees shun it."
A black scorch mark off to their left caught his eye.
"At least some of the vermin have been exterminated."
"Vermin?" the prince asked.
"Ruins,"
Grendel replied. Mwandulay had seen runes only in paintings. Renowned artists who spent time in Averillin had filled the Tolwara and the Arathion with frescoes. Most were dramatic, sweeping landscapes of the frontier at sunset or sunrise. Others featured impossibly tall mountains and unimaginably fierce rivers. In several, there were images of runes, docile figures wrapped in blankets beside dwindling fires. But some depictions cast them as ferocious savages. While not nearly as frightening as the Derg, Gazelle, Grenmorians, or dragons, they were still scary with their wild eyes and crude weapons. Mwandulay was excited by the prospect of seeing an actual ruin. Since learning about the trip to Averillin, he had compiled a mental checklist of things he wanted to see. Bears, mountain lions, gazelle, Mount Mador, giants, the sea, the Tower of Avanpartha, runes, the Great Urim River, Derg, and dragons. The last two were actually at the top of the list, gazelle at the bottom. The sinister creatures had always scared Mwandulay as a child, and the prospect of meeting a real one revealed that the fear hadn't completely disappeared. So far, he'd crossed only the mountain and the tower off his list. Grendel was nodding.
"Yes, ruins. One of the villages, I imagine. Petrogar was able to accomplish something, at least."
All Mwandulay saw was a mound of dirt on top of which lay blackened timbers.
"I do apologize for dragging you out here to this rat-infested cellar, my prince,"
Grendel said.
"But your father feels you need to suffer indignities to build character." "I don't agree. Such things are remnants of a bygone era, a time before the art. The Miraleth have no need for such foolishness. We don't require an understanding of those below us, any more than we need to experience life as a snail, or an ant. It's this notion that we are still related to them that hinders us from achieving our full potential. The only reason we are not yet recognized as a pantheon of gods is because we can't manage to allow ourselves to accept the reality that we already are. The absurdity is obvious when you consider how insane it would be to think of ourselves as equal to animals. Can you imagine believing yourself to be merely the most successful tribe of goats or cows?
Mandalay chuckled at the thought of a cow telling him to juggle.
Grendel nodded. You see what I mean? It makes no sense. The Miralith simply cannot be compared to lesser forms of life. We command the four winds to do our bidding. Does a room do that? He paused a moment, and then, fixing Mandalay with one of his hard stares to indicate he was about to provide the point of a lesson, added, Does an Instaria, a Senduar, or Umalin do that? Come with me, my prince.
Grendel urged his horse off the road toward the scorched rubble. Turning, he said,
You guards, wait here!
Mandalay's father had sent 20 Frey from his personal staff to provide protection. None were Miralith, which meant his father had sent cows to guard a god. That thought made Mandalay smile as he looked at Hyven. The captain of the guard smiled back, mistaking Mandalay's expression as approval, appreciation, or perhaps even friendship. In truth, he was imagining Hyven as a cow with drooping udders. Mandalay followed Grendel. The two trotting until they were amid the burnt ruins, which smelt unpleasantly of smoke.
You understand what I'm saying, don't you? Grendel asked in a serious tone.
Mandalay nodded despite his uncertainty.
He thought Grendel was saying that Miralith were better than everyone else, something he already knew. But he also suspected he was missing a larger point that his new tutor was making.
Mandalay often felt that way. What he couldn't determine was whether he was ignorant, or if people pretended they were smarter just to make him feel stupid. Arian often made him feel inadequate. Juggling rocks and playing with strings were things he claimed had benefits he couldn't yet understand.
Was this her way of pointing out I'm dumb?
But it could be that these things at no greater point, and she was just making a fool out of the Fane's son. Arian probably had gone home each night and laughed with friends, telling them what idiocies she'd forced the prince to do. When Grendel had explained that Arian might be dead, Mandalay hadn't felt the least bit sad.
See, I knew you would understand what I'm talking about. Grendel said, You're smarter than your father. You can see what he can't. The Fane is hopelessly mired in a fraudulent past. He can't possibly envision a future different from what he's used to, because he lacks imagination. Do you know the single most important attribute for greatness in the art?
Mandalay shook his head, even though he remembered Arian saying it was control. Something told him Grendel was looking for a different answer.
Imagination, Grendel said. The ability to think creatively. We call it the art for that exact reason. Imagination is power. And I can see great power in you, Mandalay. Great power. You won't be limited by traditions and foolish laws invented thousands of years ago by Frey who couldn't conceive of the power we wield today. Do you think Glyndora Fane would have agreed to the restrictions she placed on herself and all subsequent Frey if she had the power we do? She was a product of her time, and back then the laws were necessary. Intertribal warfare was rampant, and threatened to destroy us as a people. But can you honestly imagine any other tribe, or even all the tribes combined, successfully mounting an attack against the Miralith?
Mandalay shook his head. After seeing what his father had done to the leader of the Instaria, and having seen Mount Mador with his own eyes, he knew the power of his clan was indisputable. That's why the laws must change, or, more precisely, why others must learn that such rules no longer, and never actually did, apply to the Miraleith. Gods have no such boundaries. You see that, don't you? Wanderlei nodded again. Grindel smiled. Then a sad look stole over the tutor's face.
What's wrong?
Grindel shook his head. It's just so tragic.
What is?
That your father rules instead of you, he said, and then gave a wistful sigh. If you were Fane...
I will be Fane one day.
Grendel looked at him with a sympathetic smile. Your father isn't that old. He's just over 2100. He could rule another 1,000 years. In the meantime, you might have an accident. You could die on this very trip. Such a sad ending, when we need your wisdom so badly.
Together we might change his mind, Wanderlei said. Show him Ferrol has ordained the Miraleith as superior to all other Frey.
I've tried, believe me. My efforts were counterproductive. I convinced him to make an example of Zephron, but afterward he regretted what happened in the arena, and if anything, it has moderated his feelings toward ordinary Frey. The Fane, well, it's like trying to persuade a rock to fly. He simply doesn't know how, Grendel said. Wanderlei laughed, and Grendel laughed with him. They rode in silence through the blackened ruins. Even after days on the trail, Wanderlei still wasn't comfortable in the saddle. He didn't know why they had to ride. The soldiers didn't. They walked behind them in double rows. Grendel had insisted on the horses, but they were merely trading sore feet for a sore seat. Sitting on the animal scared him. There wasn't anything to hold on to except some flimsy hair on the thing's neck. Nothing would keep him on its back if the animal bolted. 3 times the horse had stumbled or jerked unexpectedly. Each time he'd nearly screamed. The only good thing about being on the horse was the added height. He could see farther and was well above the soldiers, which he liked. Most of them were taller than he was, but they had to look up at him when he was mounted. Your father simply doesn't have the imagination that you do. It's so unfortunate. You're already more capable of ruling than he is, yet you're impotent and treated like a child. Wanderlei was nodding. He honestly couldn't agree more. Those same thoughts had come to him on many occasions.
You really think so?
Of course. The thing is, it's not hurting us. Grendel wagged a finger between them. It's hurting everyone else. Our people could be so much more if we only freed ourselves from the restrictions of the past. Grendel sidled closer, and in a whispered voice added, I know it's wrong for me to say this, but sometimes I honestly wish some tragedy would befall your father. Not anything fatal, of course. Just something rendering him unable to rule, so that you could take over. I know that sounds terrible, but I fear your father isn't suited to guide us into the future. His rule will lead to disaster. Trust me, Wanderlei. Your father's reign will threaten our whole way of life. Then he leaned closer still. It's even possible that someone might take it upon themselves to kill the Fane to prevent that.
Kill? A Frey? That would break Ferrol's law. They would no longer be Frey.
Grendel pursed his lips, as if to say something.
then stopped himself, looking unsure. Wanderley had never seen that expression on his new tutor.
What?
Grendel shook his head.